Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Welcome back to A Pod of Their Own. This is episode 81 of A Pod of Their Own. I am Allison McCaig, and I am joined this week by my lovely co-host, Linda Serovich. Hi, Linda.
Hey, Allison.
And Kellyanne Healy. Hello, Kellyanne.
Hello, Allison. Hello, Linda.
Hello.
And we are also joined this week by a guest host, Amazing Avenue's own Grace Carbone. Hi, Grace.
Hi, Allison.
Hello, Grace.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you. We finally have another Amazing Avenue guest. It's been a while. It's been the four of us for so long.
Have we ever had another Amazing Avenue guest?
Well, no, not really. I mean, we've had Kate Feldman on the show, who is formerly Amazing Avenue, but she's not currently of Amazing Avenue. So, but yeah, very exciting. So we had Grace on to talk about movies, and we will do that because Grace is our resident movie buff. We're going to talk Oscars just for funsies, talk about our favorite baseball films because it's Oscar season. But we wanted to really only do that, but of course, like, the world just keeps happening and the Mets keep being shitty, so we have to talk about sexual harassment again. It's the sexual harassment podcast. So we will talk about that first. So more details have emerged about the Mets' toxic culture beyond just Mickey Callaway and Jared Porter, per reporting in The Athletic. I won't, like, read the entire piece, but I'll just give you some highlights. The big quote that was in, like, the subheading was, we were all pawns in this toxic workplace. So it's not just Porter and Callaway. There were others, namely Joe DeVito, who's the executive producer for content and marketing. And we already knew about Ryan Ellis, who's the former hitting performance coordinator. Both of those men have in the past made sexual comments and sent various inappropriate text messages. They quoted a bunch of them throughout the piece, but some of the highlights, lowlights, if you will, are, at least I'm not as creepy as Mickey, hashtag goals. That one was my favorite, and I put, like, large air quotes around favorite because it's like, Jesus Christ, even the team knows that Mickey is creepy, and it's literally a running gag with these other men who are doing the same shit.
Dick pick Mick.
And then the other one that I quoted here is, I've barely hit on you, so that counts for something. So literally they know the bar is in Hades, and they're out here just, like, flaunting it. Which is,
but yet, like, none of the higher ups knew about Mickey Callaway. Somehow. They were completely shocked when the report came out.
That's bullshit.
Yeah, I think we've established that.
I very rarely swear on this show, but it's bullshit.
I think we've now established that, you know, Sandy Alderson, I mean, like, the timing of it when the Mickey Callaway stuff came out, the timing of it was such that the team claims that it became aware of the Mickey Callaway stuff, like, right after Sandy Alderson started his chemotherapy treatments and was on a leave of absence. And so, like, at that point, it's kind of Sandy Alderson's word against, you know, against everybody else. But
But it's not, though, because if you go back to 2015 and with Lee Castor, I'm going to pronounce her name incorrectly, Castergeen.
Yeah.
And the whole settlement over Wilpon kind of harassing her over her pregnancy. And then the re-signing of Jose Reyes in 2016. And like Sandy Alderson said to that, I'm quoting from an article from The Guardian, trying to put aside issues of performance and talent, which is sort of the bottom line what this is about, we have done everything we can to consider other issues and make ourselves comfortable that Jose understands the mistake he made and has taken responsibility for it.
Cool.
That was 2016, 5 years later.
Are we trying to say that a old white guy is trying to protect other guys, like other, especially like old white guys? I just don't see that happening. That seems extremely unrealistic to me. I can't believe that.
Shocker. Perhaps the most, you know, notorious, the person who's been named most in this new Athletic article is David Newman, who's chief of marketing, and he's Joe DeVito's boss. So there was a lot in this Athletic piece about how he created a toxic work environment. He made various inappropriate comments to female employees during his first stint with the Mets, which lasted from 2005 to 2018, including comments about their makeup, how they were dressed, their hair, etc. There was one woman who he said would never be successful in the job because of how she wore her hair. And there was, you know, there was one woman who claimed that he discriminated against her on the basis of her pregnancy. So again, the same sort of theme again. And he said that she, quote, hasn't been the same since she had kids, and made various other inappropriate comments during meetings and things like that. So when Alderson was due to bring Newman back under the new regime, when word spread that he was bringing him back, these two of these women spoke up and went to Alderson with these complaints, and he essentially ignored them. He said that he would tell Newman to, quote, knock it off. And that's about the best he would do. And the one of the women said, quote, it was deflating. And deflating is a really good word for it, because that's how I felt reading this entire goddamn article.
Well, and the other thing to me that also stuck out was, what's her name? Holly Lindvall, I think.
Yep.
Was Holly the head Lindvall. Of HR, a woman. And everybody said they couldn't go to her because she was in charge of promotions and salaries and raises. And they said if you complained, like you wouldn't get a promotion or a raise, and because she was tight with Jeff Wilpon. So it's the whole system was built to protect the men in charge. It wasn't. There was no recourse for these women. Even a woman in charge, they couldn't even go to her. Like, what, they called her Regina?
Regina George. She was compared to, yes, Regina George from Mean Girls. A quote from one former employee, she was not liked, she was feared. So,
yeah.
I think that this speaks to this aspect of this piece is really important, because it speaks to how women can uphold these systems too if they benefit from them. So as long as you are a woman who's in proximity, in a position to power or in proximity to power, you will absolutely uphold the system that got you there every time.
Luba.
Rachel Luba.
Dang, Nabbit, I thought we would never have to mention her name again.
But it's the same sort of stuff, right? Like, it's the pick-me girls who always end up in these positions of power. You know, this HR woman willing to protect ownership because she's friends with Jeff Wilpon. Like,
Cool girl, I think, was the reference.
Yeah, Linda made that reference.
I have not watched Gone Girl, so.
you can read the book.
I didn't read the book. I probably should, but it's going to be way down on my book list. I have literally thousands of books to read before it.
You should watch the movie.
Oh, I don't have time to watch the movie. I have to read my thousands of books.
The movie and the book are both good. I have seen both. I have seen the movie and read the book, and they are both good.
Wasn't there controversy over Ben Affleck wearing like a Mets hat or something?
Yeah. So that was David Fincher, who directed it, wanted him to be wearing a Yankees hat during the scene. And Ben Affleck, being from Boston, refused, very, very strongly refused to wear the Yankees hat. And so that shut down production for, I believe, a day, maybe a day.
Oh, my God.
It was the stalemate. And then finally, like, production assistant said, hey, guys, why don't you just have Ben wear the Mets hat? It's kind of the in-between here. And both sides were like, fine. So that's how the Mets hat appeared in the film.
I respect the pettiness, honestly. The Mets were like
Switzerland. Seriously, Ben Affleck, you're an actor. It doesn't mean you're suddenly a...
No, I respect him for taking a stand. I respect that.
He was coming at it from the point of view that, like, people were gonna like harass him about it.
I mean,
yeah.
If there's one thing you have in this life, it's your rep. So,
but to be fair, he also now has been seen throwing out a gigantic cardboard cutout of Ana de Armas. So I don't know where the reputation he really wanted to uphold
it's
was.
It's true. It's a whole meme now.
Yeah.
Wasn't it his brother who was throwing it out?
Unconfirmed, but it did look like him.
Perfect. So many layers.
There's so many layers. The other like big aspect of this article, other than all the troubling details about what these shitty men in the Mets front office have done, is, you know, Sandy Alderson's response to it, because The Athletic asked Sandy Alderson about all this. And this is the one quote I'm going to read in full, because I think that it deserves, the full impact of it deserves to be felt. So in an interview with The Athletic, Sandy Alderson said, quote, "Let me try to make a point as strongly as I can, okay? Not every instance involving men, women in the workplace is a capital offense, okay? Every time something happens, it doesn't mean somebody has to be fired. There are a lot of intermediate steps that can be taken, and we've done that in a variety of different cases, and have included capital punishment as a consequence in some cases, but not every case rises to the level of execution. And that's what I honestly I think is happening with these articles. People are getting executed, including women, by the way, for reasons that are unjustifiable." So he's out here comparing
executing
a man losing his job and a man like facing one parentheses one consequence in his life for something that he has done to a public execution. He's literally acting like a man facing a consequence for sexual harassment is the same as facing a firing squad at dawn. Like, are you serious right now?
Oh, I'm gonna. God. I want to make my Ben Affleck Boston Red Sox hat stand here and say that every time something like this happens, I think somebody should be fired. That's gonna be my stand here.
Yeah. Seems but reasonable, I mean, to me.
Like, it just to me it. We saw a layer of this back in 2016 with Jose Reyes. Like, that's the incident I kept coming back to. This isn't something that's new. This is something that he has accepted, that he has been complacent and complicit in. And we discussed this a little bit, but, like, just this is what he's used to. He doesn't know anything different because this is the environment that he was raised in, he's used to, and to have that challenge is something entirely new for him and something he's obviously not comfortable with, right, and won't take responsibility for.
That's exactly it. I mean, there's a reason he's acting so defensively here, and it's because he truly does not see what is wrong here, because that is what all of these front offices are like. The Mets are the ones that are in the spotlight right now, and they deserve every bit of being in the spotlight, because clearly the culture is rotten from the inside out, and just having a new owner is not going to change that. They need to actively change it. That said,
especially when that owner has a workplace that's also been accused of sexual harassment.
Correct. That said, this isn't just a Mets problem or just a baseball problem. And it's abundantly clear that Sandy Alderson thinks this shit is normal. And he's been in, and why shouldn't we take him at his word? He's been in baseball for many, many years and in more front offices than just the Mets front office. And that's why he doesn't really get why people are so upset, because he thinks this is normal, because he's seen it in every place he's been.
Well, and also, you know, it's that type of, like, inflammatory language too, that, like, I don't want to say, like, cheapens the whole thing, but it's basically like how we get crap every time we say a player shouldn't be allowed to play when they've been accused of domestic violence. Like, we're not saying they should be in jail. Like, everybody assumes that's what we mean when we say it, because everybody immediately takes everything to, like, the nth degree. Like, there's shades here. Like, yeah. Your employer can fire you without it being a public execution. Like, that's called facing consequences.
Exactly. That's not
getting your life ruined. Like, these dudes who commit domestic violence are going to be fine. Like, yeah. They're going to go on with their lives. Even if they don't play baseball again, they're going to be fine. And it's kind of that same, like, by raising it to, like, such a ridiculous degree, then how can anybody take it seriously?
This isn't a court of law. It's a front office of a baseball team. Like, come on.
But that's the whole point. By raising it to this extreme degree, you're also dismissing it and letting people not trying to diminish the point and dismiss the point.
Yeah.
But, and like, go, I keep going back to Jose Reyes just because, I mean, he's such a staggering example. He basically threw a tantrum in 2015 when he was playing for the Rockies, and then both the Mets and the Blue Jays went to the playoffs that year. He choked his wife and threw her into a glass door that I believe December, was suspended for 51 games. And then was released by the Rockies with his almost $50 million salary still to be paid out. And then he was re-signed by the Mets. So the consequences for him were very minimal. He was DFA'd by one team, or not DFA'd, released, I'm sorry, but didn't lose any salary. The Rockies chose to release him and eat that money, which to me, that much money is just very telling that they still released him. And then he was re-signed by the Mets. By Sandy Alderson. Just like, I think it was like maybe a month or two later.
Yep.
I don't think even that.
Yep. And the very last line of the article is Sandy Alderson saying, is there ever a statute of limitations on coverage of some of this stuff? Well, no.
No.
Not until something is done.
Never coverage. Unless
it changes, no. It needs to be called out. I mean, everybody's so used to this, like, and when it's challenged, it's just like, this is the way things have been. This is the way things work. And no, that's not how it works. And this is the time to call it out. This is the time to see what it is. And oh my God, I messed up what I was going to say there. Call it out for what it is and change it.
Right. It needs to change. And I got really frustrated when I saw, like, the immediate reaction from a lot of people on this being like, oh, the Wilpon Mets, everybody, because we can't keep just chalking this up to the Wilpons. Obviously, the Wilpons were shitty. We're all glad they're gone. But this isn't just a Wilpon problem. And as long as Sandy Alderson is team president, it means nothing. Like, Steve Cohen's promise of change means nothing as long as Sandy Alderson is in his post. Because this all happened under Sandy's watch.
Yeah, honestly, Sandy's the common thread, not the Wilpons.
Right, correct. And so Sandy has to go at this point. And, like, it sucks. Like, it doesn't make me happy to say that. Like, I wish this wasn't true. But it is. He needs to go. And Cohen needs to put his money where his mouth is, his literal billions of dollars where his mouth is, and get rid of Sandy Alderson and do a little bit more than just having this law firm, like, vaguely investigate. I want to know, like, what they're doing, what their conclusions are, and what you're doing about it. I want to know that they're not just there to protect you from lawsuit.
Well, and also look at their front office. What changed? It's all a bunch of white dudes. It's like, you know, they're all interchangeable white dudes.
But these white dudes are really good.
Really good.
These white guys go. Where are we going to find other white guys like
really
them?
Really smart white guys. Where are we going to find them all?
Yeah, it's not like we can just walk into Harvard and find, like, hundreds of them.
Right?
Oh, good Come God.
On. Like, it's
oh, my
just...
mistake. My mistake.
But that's but the thing, right? Here's what I think. Sandy Alderson's just, I mean, like, I hate to say, like, Sandy Alderson needs to go. Unequivocally, he needs to go. But he's just going to be replaced by, like, Theo Epstein, who's the exact same thing. Like, the Porter stuff all happened on Epstein's watch with the Cubs. And that, like, that's the type of dude that's going to replace Sandy Alderson if and when, if he's ever fired, which I actually don't think Sandy Alderson's going to be fired for this. I think he might step down at the end of the season.
No, I was going to say, no, he's not going to be fired. He's going to probably quietly resign or retire at the end of this year. That is my prediction.
Yeah, I think that's what's likely. But like his replacement's going to be another one of these dudes who's the exact same as him.
We'll see. Maybe Cohen will put some substance behind this law firm and this investigation. And I don't know. Maybe I'm being way too optimistic.
Yeah, I'm not holding my breath.
Because, like, what?
But
what person can be team president who has those qualifications, who's not existing in baseball and an old white guy?
Well, they said he did make some changes to his hedge fund. Like, he gave them, like, paternity leave, and he did do some things, but I don't know.
I get the wanting to be like, oh, wow, that's really good, but at the same time, congratulations. You gave them what they should have had.
Yeah, the bare minimum.
Like, you were at shit, and then you went to slightly less shit. Really the best optics?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, if I were to punch you in the stomach and then said, actually, now I'm just going to punch you in the arm 4 times. I guess it doesn't hurt as much, but, like, still, you're hitting me a lot.
I would say, thank you, Mr. Cohen, sir. Thank you for not punching me in the stomach.
Thank you.
You're a god. You're the savior of the franchise.
Thank you, Uncle Steve.
Thank you, Uncle Stevie.
Hedge funds are just an entirely different animal altogether.
Yeah. I mean, but, like...
Yeah.
And I said this on Twitter recently, which is, like, the people who rush to defend guys like Alderson because of, like, something, integrity, he's always been good,
history,
something.
History, respect.
Yeah, like, that always is, like, you telling on yourself to me, because it means that you see yourself in these front office dudes, and that's not the good thing that you think it is.
If I try really hard, I could make $14 billion, too.
Yeah.
If I just really
dream.
If I grind away at my Fangraphs spreadsheets hard enough, I could be at a corner office in the Mets front office doing dollars per war and telling us all that Francisco Lindor does not deserve $340 million. That's the dream. That's the dream, folks. Oh boy. But yeah, I mean, not gonna waste too much time on this, but that's the latest with the Mets, who are currently losing to the Cubs, so we won't even go into it. I mean, they did play well really last bad. Week, but we won't go into the actual play of the New York Mets at this time. There's plenty of other podcasts for that.
Oh, because fucking Sogard was in the middle of it again.
Of course. Of course. Very good.
Because he doesn't have the vaccination weighing him down.
Yeah, that's true.
That's true.
The 5G isn't, like, you know, messing with his batting stuff.
He doesn't have a microchip, so he's able to perform better. These are facts.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
So, but let's cover something a lot more happy than the Mets sexual harassment. Let's talk about films, and let's talk about the Oscars. So before we go into kind of like our picks for the major awards, or like who the favorites are, Grace, tell us about your personal favorite films this year and your favorite performances.
Okay, so I feel like every year you get a lot of people, especially I'm on, like, there's Mets Twitter, which we all know is kind of a cesspool at times. Then there's film Twitter, which is also a very big cesspool a lot of times. So,
oh, no.
Yeah. So, I mean, any echo chamber is. But, like, I feel like a lot of the times you'll hear from people who are not seeing as many movies who will say, oh, this movie wasn't, this year wasn't as good for movies or whatever. And to that I say, well, you're never really looking at the right movies, right? Because these, a lot of the people who say that see, like, three movies that come out in a year. And they're usually the Marvel movies, the, any big blockbuster. And they're like, well, Transformers 7 wasn't that good. So this year obviously wasn't a good year for movies. This year, I feel like a lot of people have been saying that because of the pandemic and the fact that a lot of stuff that was supposed to come out got pushed back, got, you know, shifted around, anything like that. But this year genuinely was really good, if you really knew where to look. So some of my favorite films from this year, I loved my favorite film of the year, and it was a late breaker for the title, Promising Young Woman.
Yeah.
I loved that movie so much. I just blew my mind. Every aspect of it I thought was amazing. Carey Mulligan is great. The entire cast is just the best ensemble of the year. It's just every single person they found is perfect in it. Also, this year we got two Spike Lee films, which is always a joy. He did Defy Bloods, which, amazing, amazing film, one of Chadwick Boseman's last performances, and he's great in it. And then he also directed a filmed performance of David Byrne's Broadway show, American Utopia. And I saw the show on Broadway, and I loved it, because I love David Byrne. And then I saw the filmed recording of it, and this year we got quite a few filmed recordings of Broadway shows, and Hamilton was the big one. Everyone loved Hamilton. I love Hamilton. But I thought American Utopia was better made in terms of being a film. Like, it felt like a film as well as being a filmed production where they would shoot from behind the stage and everything like that. Spike Lee knows how to work a camera. Like, that's just what's going on. The Oscar nominees this year, you've got Nomadland, Minari, Sound of Metal, Judas and the Black Messiah, which is technically a 2021 release, I just want to say. It did come out this year, but they shifted all the dates around, so everything got weird. Chadwick Boseman was great in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. Underrated for me this year, you've got Palm Springs, which was really, really a lovely film. Bad Education, starring Hugh Jackman as someone from Long Island. That movie made me very happy. I thought it was really, it was fun to watch it and be like, oh, I know where that place is. Oh, I know where that place is. Happiest Season is one that hit every single, like, niche that I like. It's about Christmas, stars Kristen Stewart, it's gay, it's just all of my favorite things. And then this year was also really good for films directed by women, that, you know, Promising Young Woman, Nomadland, Happiest Season, and then you have stuff like Kajillionaire, Never Rarely, Sometimes Always, Boy State was one of the directors was a woman, the half of it, The Assistant, Shirley. There's a lot of really good stuff to find this year. So yeah, this is a really good year. Sorry if I rambled.
And no, absolutely. It's the first year two women have been nominated for Best Director at once, right?
Yes. So when that, I love waking up and watching the nominations as they happen live. I actually, I overslept this year, which was really upsetting to me. So I woke up and the nominations had already come out. So I didn't look at my phone at all. I went onto YouTube. I watched the whole thing. When I saw that Chloe Zhao and Emerald Fennell were nominated in Best Director, 100% honesty, I started to cry. It was such a moment for me. I remember, I mean, Kathryn Bigelow is the only woman to have ever won Best Director in 93 years of Academy history. And we'll get to this later on, but I do think that this year there will be a second. And just to see that, I remember when Ava DuVernay made Selma. And I loved Selma. I thought it was such an amazing film. And I was like, well, she's got to get nominated. Like, everyone was like, yeah, she's going to get nominated. And then she wasn't. And I was heartbroken, especially since I think the guy who directed The Imitation Game got nominated, which is...
Jesus Christ.
It's a very, very bland film, to put it lightly. Like, it's not... In terms of the direction that Ava DuVernay put into that film, where she's going out there and she's recreating the march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, and you're watching these people get sprayed down with fire hoses. She's recreating the Binghamton church bombing where four little girls were killed. And it's such effective filmmaking. And when you think about the fact that, here's a fun fact, if you've seen Selma and you've seen the speeches that David Oyelowo gives as Martin Luther King, you're thinking, wow, he's really good as Martin Luther King. Those speeches aren't real Martin Luther King speeches. Steven Spielberg bought the rights to all of Martin Luther King's speeches, pretty much, like his big speeches, so Ava DuVernay couldn't use them. So she went, studied all of Luther King's, Dr. Luther King's speeches, and then wrote speeches that would sound like something he would give.
That's amazing. Wow.
That's incredible.
Yeah. So the amount of work she put into that to see it, literally, I think that film got 2 nominations, and it was Best Song and Best Picture. And I remember at the time being like, how are you nominating this film for Best Picture when you're saying the only thing it is in the top 5 of, other than Picture, is Song?
Song. Right.
And the Ridiculous. Song's great. I love the song. But you're telling me you're not nominating David Oyelowo, you're not nominating Ava DuVernay for directing or for writing, you're not nominating this film for these sorts of things, and instead you're giving it to films like The Imitation Game, which, again, if you like it, that's great. It's kind of a bland film in comparison.
I liked Imitation Game because I'm a Benedict Cumberbatch stan, but okay. I admit that it's very, like, you know, it's just, it was fine. It's a movie. It was good. I enjoyed watching it, but it's not anything special.
Yeah. If you want to see a good Benedict Cumberbatch performance, I'm not a huge Benedict Cumberbatch person. I have to be in the right mood. But a movie of his just came out. I think it's on video on demand. I think I got a screener for it somehow, but it's called The Courier. And it's like a Cold War. He's basically a businessman that goes back and forth from Russia to sort of take the notes from the spy who's giving information to the British and American governments about, like, potential bombings and stuff like that. It was really well done. He's also in The Mauritanian, which I really, really liked, but I liked him in it, but it took a minute to get used to, because as soon as you see him, you're like, oh, this is Benedict Cumberbatch. He's a British actor. And then he goes into this almost Blanche DuBois southern accent. and I'm like, whoa.
It's very jarring, I imagine, with his face.
Like, I was like, if it was just a little bit toned down, it probably wouldn't have been as jarring, but it was literally like, I do so rely on the kindness of strangers.
As good as Daniel Craig's southern accent.
Oh my God.
The thing is, Knives Out is supposed to be funny, so you can take it as, like, outlandish. The Mauritanian is about a man being held at Gitmo. It is not funny. Yeah.
Never mind. Yeah. Because I love Daniel Craig in Knives Out so much.
Oh, he's great in Knives Out. And now he's making a mucho buck for the 2 sequels.
Yep.
I will watch all the sequels.
I am so glad that you loved Promising Young Woman, and I love Promising Young Woman. That was my favorite movie of this year by far. I haven't seen all the nominees for Best Picture, but I've seen, I think, at least the majority, if not almost all of them. And Promising Young Woman was my favorite by a lot. I loved that movie so much. I just want to give Carey Mulligan all the Oscars, and just, so good.
I would give Carey Mulligan all the Oscars for pretty much her entire career. I just watched Wildlife because I was like, I saw Promising Young Woman. She's really good. Let me watch. I've owned this on Blu-ray for a little bit. Let me watch it. And I put it on. I was like, how is she real? How can she do everything that she does in her career and just be so good at everything? So watch Wildlife.
Wildlife. Good to know.
It's her, Jake Gyllenhaal, and it's directed by Paul Dano.
Like, she was also perfect as Daisy in Gatsby, too.
Yeah, I didn't like The Great Gatsby, but her and Leonardo DiCaprio are perfect cast.
They were perfect, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. I wish the rest of the movie was better, because they were so good in it.
The casting was perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My other favorite movie of this year that I saw was One Night in Miami, which I'm sad that didn't get nominated, because I thought it was really good.
Yeah.
It was interesting because I saw it, like, very soon after Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, and they're both plays adapted to film. And I loved Ma Rainey's Black Bottom for the acting, but I actually didn't think it was, like, it adapted well. I didn't think that the play adapted well to film, and I think I would have enjoyed the viewing experience more if I had seen it as a stage play, as it's meant to be seen. But I didn't feel that way about One Night in Miami for some reason, even though it's also a stage play. I don't know why, but I felt the adaptation was better, even though the acting in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom was incredible. Viola Davis is obviously a queen, and Chadwick Boseman acted his ass off in it. He's probably going to get the Oscar for that.
Yeah, I'm really hoping he... I mean, would... here's my thing. I love Chadwick Boseman in that movie, and I love him as a whole. If I had an Oscar ballot, I'd probably vote for him, but I do think that the best performance by a lead actor this year was Riz Ahmed in Sound of Metal.
Oh, he was so good. I saw Sound of Metal, and he was incredible in it.
It's such a good field this year. Like, it genuinely, if any of the five men nominated, you know, Chadwick, Anthony Hopkins, Riz Ahmed, Steven Yeun, and Gary Oldman, if any of them won, I wouldn't be upset. I don't think Gary Oldman has a chance in hell, and unfortunately, I don't think Steven Yeun does either, but, like, if any of them won, if I'd be like, yeah, totally, I'm into it. This year's really good. I will say that. This year's Oscars is one of my favorites since I've really gotten into it.
Imagine, like, a field and there's Gary Oldman in it and he doesn't have a chance in hell. It's incredible.
Well, I mean, up until Darkest Hour, he had only been nominated once in his entire career.
Which is crazy to me, because he's so good.
It was Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, and then he got nominated for Darkest Hour. And now this is almost, because Mank was beloved as, like, a sort of a tech piece. You know, the cinematography is great. It's very flashy in terms of recreating old Hollywood. But if I completely lost where my train of thought was on that, because I just rewatched Mank, and I think Amanda Seyfried is actually the best part of that movie.
She's so good in it. Yeah,
she is ridiculously good. I would like to point out that now two of the four, if you're including Katie, plastics, have been nominated for Oscars.
Which is wild. And
if Lacey Chabert ever did anything other than Hallmark movies, she might get there too.
Yeah, it's so true. I will admit that I only watched the first, was it half of Mank? I can't remember if it was the night I was recording the podcast or was doing something else, but Michael put it on and I watched like the first half of it and then I bailed because I had something else to do. But I also was not super into it, but it's very much like not my type of movie, but I appreciated the acting a whole lot in it.
It's a film nerd movie.
It extremely is.
I watch it and I'm like, oh, I know all this. I know who this person is. I know what that is. Like, I'm watching it and I'm like, oh yeah, I love this. I love that sort of stuff. I watch all sorts of documentaries about old Hollywood. There's an MGM documentary that's 6 hours long and I've seen it probably 100 times. It never changes. It's was stopped in 1994. There's no new information in this thing. But it's just nice to like watch it and be like, oh, I like old Hollywood.
My dad's a huge film buff, and my dad and I were talking this morning about the Oscars and how, and I am a big animated film person. I love animated films, and it's interesting because this year's the animated film field, I feel, is like weaker than usual, in comparison to the rest of the field, which I agree is very strong. I saw Soul, which I think is going to win. It was fantastic. I saw Wolfwalker, which was really great. I wish that had gotten more attention because that film was beautiful. The animation was gorgeous, and I really enjoyed it. And I think Onward is nominated, and then those are the only three I had seen. The other two I've not seen.
What are the other two? I know Shaun the Sheep, Farmageddon is nominated.
Yes.
Because that was a bit of a shock. Everyone thought that the Croods movie was going to... That's the thing. This year's animated film field, weirdly, was very weak as a whole. Like, everyone had Onward, Soul, Wolfwalkers penciled in. And then I genuinely can't remember what the fifth nominee
is.
It's
the one about the astronaut who wants to ride...
Over the Moon.
Over the Moon. That's right.
I think that one a lot of people had penciled into, but there was like...
Linda,
JD, yes! Just hit a solo homer.
Just singers. And we should also note that Taiwan Walker has been ejected from this game.
Oh, dear.
He was ejected after he exited. He was jawing to the ump, and the ump ejected him, and Taiwan Walker was just like, okay, I'm out of this game, so.
Whatever.
It doesn't really matter. Because there were two bad strike calls that were missed. I mean, there was a low strike. And then there was the bad low strike call, and then there was the next batter swung it, like, just broke its strike three, and it was called a ball. And it walked her on, and it was just that.
Yeah, it was bad.
But it's like, that's just bad umpiring.
you know. Sorry. So yeah, animated films. Yes,
Just Stingers did a good job.
Good job, Just Stingers.
I can't help it. Doc and Smith needs to do something with Grace on the podcast.
I know. Then we can have the full brand going. Then we can have the full brand going. But yeah, animated films, not super strong this year. But my dad also...
I didn't like Onward, is that?
I liked it, but it wasn't as good as Soul.
My favorite,
Here's the other issue with the animated category at the Oscars is that it came around in 2001, I believe, right? And so the first winner was weirdly Shrek, which was up against Monsters Incorporated, which Monsters Incorporated, here's a fun fact that will tell you how young I am. That was the first movie I ever saw in the theater. I was 3 years old.
Grace.
For me, that was Lion King.
But the thing is with that category is, here's another fun fact now that I'm just viewing them. Shrek and Shrek 2, this isn't age-related. Okay. Weirdly enough, the Cannes Film Festival, which is like really serious films premiere at the Cannes Film Festival. It's usually a lot of like foreign stuff. It's a French film festival. They're very serious. Shrek and Shrek 2 both made it into competition there.
Shrek is a good movie.
Shrek is a great movie.
I was going to say Shrek 2 is to me one of the few films, I think probably the only film where I thought the sequel was better than the original.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they're both good.
No, they're both excellent, but I liked Shrek 2 a little more.
The thing is with the animated film category is that historically, if you're a Disney or a Pixar film, they can pencil your name in. You're going to win. There's almost never do you see them lose. I remember a few years ago, what was it? There was like an upset that a Disney Pixar movie didn't win. Everyone was like, what the hell?
Was it Coraline?
Maybe that might be what I'm thinking of.
Let me look.
Coraline is one of my favorites, non-Disney, non-Miyazaki animated films of all time. I love that movie.
That is one of the few Neil Gaiman books I have not read.
There's like the Lego Movie missed at the Oscars.
I was so upset about that.
There's no especially so mad about that. Song got nominated.
Yes!
For that movie to miss. And like, if you look at the competition, you're like, you definitely could have penciled that movie in somewhere. And it probably was better than whatever the winner was that year.
It was so creative. The ending was such a twist.
But any Disney movie that gets into that category, it wins. Like, Disney or Pixar, usually... that wins. You know what the upset is I'm thinking of? It's when Spider-Verse won.
Oh, that's right.
Which deserved. I was just going to say it was not Coraline.
That was a very big, oh my God, they really went for this. And we were talking about One Night in Miami. They just announced that the writer of the play and the adaptation for the film, Kemp Powers, who also co-directed and wrote Soul, is now the co-director for the new Spider-Verse film.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah. So cool. it's gonna be a good one.
When it comes to was very good.
Yes. Yeah,
what Disney movie did that beat out? Was it Moana?
No. So the year of Moana lost to Zootopia.
I love
Zootopia. So it lost. I was gonna say it lost to an in-house.
Yes, it was
rivalry.
Usually if a Disney movie loses, it's to another Disney movie. Like there's no. I'm gonna look up right now what Spider-Verse beat because I remember it was Best Animated Feature. But, yeah, so usually that category does go to the Disney movies. Also, if we're talking about animated features, only 3 times in history have animated films been nominated for Best Picture. And only one of them did it when there wasn't an animated feature film category. Because the category came around in 2002. Yep. But the first animated film ever nominated for Best Picture. That's my personal favorite Disney movie of all time.
Mine too.
I saw that in the theater, Grace.
Yes, I saw that in the theater as well, and I was 2.
Here's a fun fact.
You were 2? What? Good help, Killian.
I didn't watch... So, as a kid, usually you do watch a whole lot of Disney movies, right?
Yes.
Until I was 16, I had only seen 3 Disney movies.
Wow.
And I'm not counting Pixar because, like, up until, like, 2007, they were kind of separate entities that worked together, but they weren't the same thing. Up until I was 16, I saw Snow White, Beauty and the Beast, and Lilo and Stitch.
Lilo and Stitch rules. God.
And wow. So I'm looking right now, Spider-Verse beat Incredibles 2, Isle of Dogs, Mirai, and Ralph Breaks the Internet.
Which are all great movies.
Oh, yeah.
Not to say it wasn't deserved. Into the Spider-Verse was so good. Another non-Disney animated film, best animated film winner that I'm going to shout out is one of my favorites of all time. Kubo and the Two Strings is the 2016 winner.
It wasn't the 2016 winner.
It wasn't?
No, it lost to Zootopia.
It lost to Zootopia. What the hell? Kubo and the Two Strings, was nominated. Kubo and the Two Strings is amazing and one of my favorites ever.
I want to shout out one of my favorite non-Disney winners, a movie I saw in the theaters when I was young, Wallace and Gromit, The Curse of the Were-Rabbit.
Wallace and Gromit
is so good.
It's just the best.
I haven't seen that movie, but I love Wallace and Gromit.
That Aardman does no wrong in my book. Even their bad stuff is good.
I can't believe Kubo and the Two Strings didn't win. Anyway.
Did Anastasia get nominated?
Anastasia, I believe, came out before the category was invented.
Yes. Aww. So Anastasia was 1998.
Yeah, the first year was 2001. I'm looking at the nominees right now. It was Shrek, one. And the other two nominees, there were only three nominees that year, were Jimmy Neutron, Boy Genius.
Oh, Jesus. Mary and Joseph.
And Monsters, Inc.
Yo, but the following year... is kind of a showdown of titans between Spirited Away and Lilo and Stitch, and Spirited Away won, and Spirited Away is, you know, like, Spirited Away is like a top three favorite film for me of all time, like, not just animated, like, that is, I love that movie. Oh, I Wallace and Gromit beat out Howl's Moving Castle, speaking of Miyazaki movies.
And The Incredibles beat out Shark Tale, which stars Martin Scorsese.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Oh, Kellyanne, the year that Coraline was nominated, Up was the winner. So, I mean.
Yes, I looked that up.
There you go.
I looked that up.
I want to share a controversial opinion right now that we're talking about Up.
Do you not like Up?
The first 5 minutes of Up are absolutely fantastic. That's it. But I feel like a lot of people think that Up is better than it is because of those first 5 minutes.
Yeah. I agree with that. It's a good movie.
I
will not lie. I have not gotten past that first segment just because, like, it made me cry so much. I have not watched the rest of the movie to this day.
Oh, I was sobbing.
I mean, the rest of it's not sad at all, Kellyanne. So.
No, it's not.
It's an adventure.
I know, but it takes me a while to get past things if I am way too emotional. Like, I'm still not over The Rise of Skywalker. And it's been over a year.
I'm also not over The Rise of Skywalker because I hated that movie so much.
Me too.
It was just awful.
Oh, Kellyanne has a year-long grudge now and will not watch any Star Wars content.
I didn't see it when it came out in the theaters because I just was like, this isn't going to be good.
I mean, I knew it wasn't going to live up to my expectations after The Last Jedi, which I love.
Me too.
I just love it. It has the best visuals to me of all nine movies.
That's Ryan Johnson.
I love him.
I've doubt.
And I said, and I have sworn off like anything Disney until his trilogy is in development. Or I heard he's now rumored to direct an episode of The Mandalorian.
Yeah, he is.
So he needs to get back into the fold here, and maybe I'll start watching Disney again.
I also wouldn't blame him if he didn't go back to doing Star Wars.
Yeah, honestly, I would not.
The fact that people are still like, oh, I hate Rian Johnson. Ugh. The reason why a lot of people hate Rian Johnson's The Last Jedi is because it was like, it was essentially did what like original Star Wars did, was like, it would sort of flip the script and be like, oh, you think that the hero is going to win here? He's not. He has to learn that what he did was actually the dumb thing and that purple haired Laura Dern was correct.
Oh my gosh. Also, like, he early on in that movie literally went against an order from General Leia Organa. Like, come on.
And I love Oscar Isaac, but he has to learn his role. He's not beating Carrie Fisher.
No, and that's the whole thing. Oscar Isaac really, really loved The Last Jedi. From what I've heard, he loved that role. And he was really pissed. how his character went in The Rise of Skywalker, which I don't blame him.
Yeah, it was... Oscar Isaac is just, like, a fun guy. Like, I love... He does, like, stuff, and I'm like, yeah, you're doing the right thing here. He has the world's best agent. I feel like there's actors who have the world's worst agent where they do just continuous crap. He's just consistently in good movies. Inside Llewyn Davis. I really could just stop there. But he's just... Ex Machina. Just stuff like that. He's consistently doing these little movies that no one else would think to do, and then he turns around and it's the best thing ever.
Before we did not come through.
Oh, no.
No one came through except for Just Dingers.
Yeah. They had a rally and it didn't go anywhere.
Well, again, there's still a whole chunk of this game left. I think this is, we're now going into the fifth?
No, it's the sixth.
It's the sixth.
Oh, it is? Okay.
It's the bottom of the fifth now.
Okay.
Before we move on to picking like our picks for the major categories, I would be amiss if I didn't mention a film that my dad talked about in our conversation this morning. He talked about the, because my dad is a big, in addition to just being a film buff generally, his favorite category is always foreign film. And mm-hmm. he said that his favorite film of this year was the foreign film nominated Covetous Aida, which I'm probably butchering.
Covetous Aida.
Yeah, which is, and I'm seeing a headline now when I Googled it, is this year's most devastating urgent contender. So it's a Bosnia and Herzegovina film, and it's about a UN translator during, you know, when Serbia is crumbling, to save her family. So it's apparently really, really good. And you know, it's, my dad said he liked it even more than Minari, as far as like non-English language films, although Minari is not nominated in foreign film. It's nominated Best Picture
because the thing is, the category is no longer foreign language film, to sort of remove that confusion. It's now international feature.
Right.
So because
Minari is American.
Minari is an inherently American film, much like The Farewell from 2019. They are inherently American films that just so happen to be primarily in another language. I am always bad at seeing foreign language films. It's just whatever, I end up not catching them. They're usually hard to find a lot of the times because bigger chains don't carry them. You have to find the time to go to an independent theater to see it. But I will say that this year, one of my favorite foreign films, international features, was the documentary Collective, which is about what country was it? It was, I think it was Romania. And they had this big concert at this place. You know, it was like a club and they had a concert in there. It was Romania. They had a concert in there and pyrotechnics went off and lit the place on fire. People died, there were tons of injuries and stuff like that, and it's about this group of investigative journalists who are actually sports journalists who take it upon themselves to go in and find out what happened and sort of hold the government's feet to the fire. It is an amazing, I'm a big journalism movie, I love movies that are like taking you through the steps that these journalists have to go through to get the true story and to, you know, tell people what's going on. Such an amazing film. When you're watching, it's happening in real time that these sports journalists are becoming major national headline investigative journalists.
My dad also recommended that movie in our conversation too. So he's nailing all the highlights.
Just to bring this into, if we're going to start talking about picks, I don't think that Collective isn't even nominated in that category. I believe it's just nominated in documentary, but I do think that the winner of international feature this year will be the film also nominated for Best Director, and that's Another Round, starring Mads Mikkelsen. I haven't seen it yet. Again, I'm bad at watching foreign films, but I have heard only good things about it.
God.
The Bosnia Herzegovina film is on Hulu, by the way, so if people are interested in watching that, that is actually a rare instance where it is accessible. But yeah, normally... Yeah. Foreign films, it's really hard to get your hands on them unless you like, my dad has like a MoMA subscription or something, that he's able to like watch all these things, and I'm really jealous of it.
Hulu really good this year about having a lot of these international features. They have Quo Vadis Aida, they actually have, I'm looking right now, they have Collective, I know they have Another Round, so Hulu has a lot of the nominees this year. I know they have Nomadland. They have United States versus Billie Holiday. They have a bunch of the nominees just by virtue of a lot of these studios just said, well, we're going to put them out somewhere that people can see them. And Hulu's owned by Disney, so they have a lot of the Searchlight features on there as well.
Yeah, yeah. As much as I would like Promising Young Woman to win Best Picture, I don't think it's what's going to happen. I don't know.
So I don't know how deep we want me to go on my picks. I could do something for everything, but I'm going to guess we probably want to stay above the line with just your big categories, picture, director, the acting. I'm even going to throw in the screenplays.
Throw in screenplay, please do.
So I'm going to start from adapted screenplay and work my way up to the big stuff. Adapted screenplay, I do think currently that the lead, like the screenplay in the lead is Nomadland, but I would watch out for The Father and Borat. And I'm going to explain, The Father probably isn't going to get much else. So they might, if they're going to spread everything around, and Nomadland's probably going to win quite a few awards, they might say, okay, well, we'll vote for The Father here. That does happen a lot, that they'll say, well, we'll spread the love. And Borat had an unusually good showing. Everyone thought it was just going to get Maria Bakalova, and Borat got nominated somehow in adapted screenplay. I think it showed up one other place. My favorite thing with Borat subsequent movie film being nominated is that if it wins, the name they have to say and the name that they have to inscribe on the little statue is Borat subsequent movie film delivery of prodigious bribe to American regime for make benefit once glorious nation of Kazakhstan. So amazing. That has to be written on the Oscar.
Amazing.
And then original screenplay, it seems to be sort of a two-horse race between Promising Young Woman and The Trial of the Chicago 7. I do think Promising Young Woman is going to win just because it won WGA, which is usually a big indicator for that sort of thing. But again, if they're going to try and spread it around and they think that Promising Young Woman is going to pick up something somewhere else, that could be Trial. But I do think Trial is probably going to have a better shot of winning another award than Promising Young Woman might. So they might just vote Promising Young Woman here. That's my prediction, is that Emerald Fennell is going to win this one. Supporting actress. The acting categories this year are weird because there hasn't been, I think there's been one sweeper, and that's supporting actor that's won everything. Past couple of years have been kind of boring as an Oscar buff, that a lot of the awards would just, every single award show, like last year, every single award shows, it was Joaquin Phoenix, Renee Zellweger, Brad Pitt, Laura Dern. There was no surprise. There was no, you know, tension or anything. It was just the same four people every single time. This year, there's a lot of variety. I think Yoo Jung-yeon is going to win for Minari for supporting actress. But again, I'm going to say watch out for Maria Bakalova, because she's showed up everywhere she shouldn't have. Borat did a little bit better than everyone was expecting. And a lot of the times they do like to give an award to an ingenue. And I don't think that that's going to happen in Best Actress. So they might want to do it here. My guess would be Yoo Jung-yeon, but again, watch out for Maria Bakalova. The only sweeper this year has been Daniel Kaluuya for supporting actor. For Judas and the Black Messiah. He's won everything. My favorite thing about the supporting actor category this year is that Daniel Kaluuya and Lakeith Stanfield are nominated in it. So somehow in the film Judas and the Black Messiah, both Judas and the Black Messiah, are supporting actors. In the lead. I guess you could say the lead is maybe racism.
Sure.
But smart money's on Daniel Kaluuya, right? Like, there's almost no way he loses. He's won everything. I would say maybe watch out, because Sound of Metal did pretty well. Paul Raci might get the nod here just because Daniel Kaluuya is going to be nominated again in the future. Like, that's just going to happen. This is a second nomination. He's well-respected. People like him. They might say, well, let's, you know, enough people might say, well, let's vote for Paul Raci because this is a true supporting performance. He's never been nominated before. He's in his 60s. We don't know if he'll ever get here again. We'll show him some love. And there also might be a case that Daniel Kaluuya and Lakeith split votes. There might be people who like Judas and the Black Messiah who like both of them. Half of them might vote for Daniel Kaluuya. Half of them might vote for Lakeith Stanfield, and that opens up the field for someone. Smart money might say that if it opens up the fields for Sacha Baron Cohen, but I like to live on the edge and say it's Paul Raci.
I was going to say, I think Sacha Baron Cohen is low-key my favorite performance of this year in Trial of the Chicago 7.
I liked him in so my thing is with that movie is I haven't watched it since it first came out, and I feel like my feelings about it were sort of hampered by the ending that I thought was absolutely awful.
Michael complained incessantly about the ending, which was terrible.
It's so, so, like, baity that I can't.
It's so campy and bad. I mean, it's very Sorkin-y, right? Yes. It's very Sorkin-y.
If it even just took the music away, it would be better. Yeah. But the music kills it. So, like, I feel like I should probably rewatch it, but there's other films that I also want to rewatch, so we'll see where my time gets allotted. Best Actress is the craziest race of the year. I will say that. This is absolutely insane. This is essentially the 2007 Supporting Actress campaign all over again, in that there hasn't been a single person who's won more than one precursor. So your big awards, you've got Andra Day won the Globe, Carrie Mulligan won Critics' Choice, Viola Davis won SAG, Frances McDormand won BAFTA. I have no clue who's going to win. I genuinely don't. I won't pretend that I will, because I think that if I do that, and I, you know, that's just dumb. No one knows. There's absolutely no one who knows exactly what's going to happen. My head still says Carrie Mulligan. I still say, okay, my head says, yeah, she's never won before. She's kind of overdue. People love her in the industry. You know, she was nominated like 12 years ago and never got nominated again. And now this is it. The movie's well-liked. Frances McDormand, Viola Davis, have already won before. Vanessa Kirby, this is her first nomination. Her film isn't nominated for anything else, so it's just sort of a gimme. Same thing with Andra Day. Carrie Mulligan is probably smart money. My gut has said, since I saw Nomadland, that Frances McDormand is going to win her third Oscar. And I don't know why I think that, but she just won the BAFTA, and there's a lot of crossover there. So I could very well be right. And I usually fill out my ballot day of, so Sunday I'm going to fill out my ballot. I might check off Frances McDormand as who I think it's gonna be. Just that's my gut here. Watch out for Viola Davis. She could have history on her side there, because she would be only the second Black woman to ever win that award. She's the most nominated Black woman in, like, Black actress in Oscar history, with a whopping 4 nominations. But yeah, this Dealer's Choice, you got to go with what you think is going to win. I have no clue, but I, you know, that's just what's going to happen.
It's a very fun category, though. Such a good field. Ugh.
It's a great field. And the fun thing is, with the Oscars every year, I don't know if it's going to change this year, because they have new producers who are trying different stuff this year, which most of what they said I genuinely love as ideas. They're going to try and make it more movie-like. They're going to, they're focusing more on letting people say what they want to say in their acceptance speech, which is always my favorite part. But I usually, the order of the awards too is Best Actress is the second to last Oscar of the night. So if they keep the order they usually do, we could be going into, you know, 11 o'clock at night having no clue who's going to win this damn category.
Yep.
It's so much fun. Best Actor this year, smart money's on Chadwick Boseman. I just read an article before from Variety that said that some people in the Academy are voting for Anthony Hopkins, thinking that Chadwick Boseman's going to win, and they're just going to vote for him, for Anthony Hopkins. And if enough people do that, it could swing to Anthony Hopkins. I liked The Father. I didn't love it. I thought he was great in it, but I didn't love the film as a whole. So, again, any of them could win. I do think it's going to be Chadwick Boseman, though. Because how cruel would it be if they're doing the in-person award ceremony at Union Station, and Chadwick Boseman's widow gets all dressed up and goes there, and she's had to give tearful acceptance speech after tearful acceptance speech this entire season, and then they read Best Actor and it's not Chadwick Boseman.
Right.
That would be absolutely crushing.
I feel like kind of has it on his side here.
I don't want to say that he's winning it because he's dead, because he's not. I think even if he hadn't passed away, I think he would have been in heavy contention. I don't think it would have been as much of a lock. I think Anthony Hopkins and Riz Ahmed probably would have posed more significant threats. But I do think that his career, his status in the industry, having been in a Best Picture nominee 2 years ago, I think he probably still would have been in the lead to win this award. But I think that people, you can't say no to that. You can't, you know, Heath Ledger won, Peter Finch won. They were undeniable performances that also had someone who hadn't been honored before.
Right. And I think, like, I haven't seen The Father, so I can't judge that. But The Sound of Metal was really good, and his performance was fantastic in it. But Chadwick Boseman just had the more dramatic performance. Like, I don't know how to describe it. The more Oscar-y
performance. I like to watch movies, and I like to say, okay, here's the Oscar clip, because they always have the Oscar clip that's like some big scene in the film. And so I like to watch and be like, where's the Oscar clip? The thing is with Chadwick Boseman is I don't know what the Oscar clip is, because they're all Oscar clips.
Yeah, it's literally a movie full of Oscar clips. For both him and Viola Davis.
Oh, yeah. Best director. I do think that a woman is going to win again this year. And I go, this is the other sweeper of the year. Chloe Zhao has literally not won lost a single award. She has won every single award. And coming into this year, people thought David Fincher was going to win because he's overdue. You know, Chloe Zhao would just be an honor to be nominated. She has won pretty much every critics prize. She has won every single televised award. She's won every guild award. This is Chloe Zhao's. Chloe Zhao is going to be the second woman to ever win Best Director.
And which will be very exciting.
Yes. So here's a recommendation. I don't know if it's streaming anywhere. I'll check. Her film before this called The Rider. If you like Nomadland, you're going to like The Rider. I loved The Rider. It's on Pluto TV for free. So if you want to watch it, it's there. I went back and looked because I knew when I watched it, I saw it in the theater and I wrote like a little Letterboxd review afterwards. And I went back and read it because I wanted to see what I said about it. And I said, I think something to the effect of, Chloe Zhao is a new master of cinema, and we're just not ready for it yet. And that was 3 years ago.
Yep. And here's
I was on the ball with that one. And then again, Best Picture, I think it's going to be Nomadland, which is fun because if Nomadland wins, obviously it's the second film ever directed by a woman to win Best Picture, but also Frances McDormand makes Oscar history because she will be the first woman to ever win for acting and for producing a film. Not even in like, you know, the same year, just in general, no woman who has ever won both for producing and acting in a film. Several men have done that.
Very cool. I agree with you, Grayson. I'm not even like a super like steeped in movie person, but like anyone who said that this wasn't a good year for movies is wrong. Like I watched a bunch of movies I loved this year, and like probably more than a lot of recent years before this. Yeah, it was great. And you know, streaming services almost make it in a way, like, even though like COVID affected the ability to see movies in theaters, the streaming services almost made it like more accessible for people to just like see all the Oscar nominated films like at once.
Because a lot of these like distributors, not only did they, you know, you had a lot of streamers in the awards hunt, and a lot of them gave their movies to streamers to sort of stream on their platforms. You also have a lot of these films adopting a PVOD, which is premium video on demand, which basically means when they would release the film at the same time, they'd put it at $20 to rent on Apple or whatever, wherever you rent your films from. So it was able for you to, for a little bit more than your average movie ticket price, to watch the movie at home. And that was very interesting. Now, I'm a big, as wants to be a filmmaker, I'm a very big person on the theatrical experience. So I don't love the idea of what HBO Max did, where they were like, day and date, you can stream it like in a regular world. Right now with COVID, I'm fine with it. But like in a regular world where there's no COVID and we can go to the movie theater and it's fine in like a year or two, I don't like the idea of doing it at the same exact time, just because that's how you start killing movie theaters. But I do think that the window needs to be shortened, because the window prior was 90 days. I think that if you cut that in half, which I think a lot of them are talking about doing now, 45 days, so that's what, 7 weeks, 6 weeks, after a film comes out in the theater, you can stream it online, you know, pay $6 to rent it or whatever. I think that's a good idea. I think you're going to start making films a lot more accessible that way. I think there's a middle ground that needs to be hit here.
I agree. I agree with that. Before we move on to walk-off wins, since we're having a film segment here, I think we would be amiss if we did not all talk about our favorite baseball films. So, Grace, what is your favorite baseball film of all time?
Okay, I'm a big baseball movie dork. I cry at pretty much all of them. That's just the thing that happens. It's when the camera sweeps over the field. It's just the green of the grass. It makes me think of, like, baseball, and I cry. My favorite all time is A League of Their Own.
Yeah. That was,
I think I went back and looked, you know, the movies I knew I saw when I was a kid. That was the first movie I ever saw that was directed by a woman, too. And that was a movie that made me feel like I could do anything. I do have a little list here of other baseball films I like, and I'm just going to read them out. And, you know, I'm sure you guys love some of them too, so we can talk about them then. But Moneyball, Field of Dreams, The Bad News Bears, Major League, Bull Durham, 42, I just rewatched, starring the late wonderful Chadwick Boseman. The Natural, obviously The Sandlot. I'm actually, you can't see it, but I'm wearing a Sandlot shirt right now, covered camp. The Bingo Long Traveling All-Stars and Motor Kings is a good underrated one. Pride of the Yankees about Lou Gehrig, Eight Men Out, 61. And then two documentaries I loved, Ken Burns Baseball. Anyone who knows me knows I love Ken Burns. Absolutely love the man. And then an underseen one that came out about 2 years ago, I believe, Heading Home, The Tale of Team Israel, which is about the 2017 Team Israel in the World Baseball Classic. And it does feature former Met Ty Kelly. And it's great. So that's a selection of some of my favorite baseball movies.
Heck yeah. Linda, what's your favorite baseball movie ever?
Well, I guess it depends on what kind of mood I'm in. But Major League, I think Major League was like the first baseball movie I ever saw. So I think like Major League just always holds a special place in my heart. And I want one reliever to come into Wild Thing. Like, it's like, how has no reliever done this?
There is a reliever who does it. It's James Karinchak for the Indians, and he's an anti-vaxxer. So
no.
Which is that's a very Wild Thing to do, is to be like, I'm not getting this. Like, that's Charlie Sheen would say that.
True.
He's really deep into character, James Karinchak.
Well, and also, like, when David Wright came back, he had Joe Boo in his locker. Like, you know, it's timeless.
Just a bit outside.
Yeah, and I was going to say, Bob Uecker is just incredible in the movie. Like, he makes the movie. But then 42, it was on HBO one night when I still lived at home, and it was way too late, and I shouldn't have been watching it, and I shouldn't have been watching it at bedtime. And I just kept crying and crying. I was like, this was a mistake. But Chadwick Boseman was just so good in it. And he had so much left to give, and it sucks on so many levels. But yeah, and on the, can I say the Simpsons baseball episode?
Yes, you definitely can.
Of course you can.
Mattingly, I thought I told you to shave those sideburns.
get off my team.
All right, I have to interrupt this for a second. Rojas just got ejected.
Oh. Uh-oh. Oh, dear.
This game has been a nightmare for called strikes and balls and, oh my God, sorry, okay.
Yeah, but, I was reading a Simpsons book that I ordered for the library, and they were saying that episode kind of like validated them, because after that they realized they could get any guest star that they wanted, since they got like these nine like giant like baseball players at the time, like Roger Clemens, Ken Griffey Jr., Daryl Strawberry. Like,
when Daryl Strawberry just has the single tear.
Yeah, Daryl.
That episode is in the Baseball Hall of Fame.
It is. And they did a documentary on it. It was like a mockumentary. And they got like Jill Buck, Bob Costas. And they were like, Mr. Burns was ahead of his time. He called for the lefty to face the lefty. And it was hysterical. Like, they were actually really good at it. And it was called Springfield of Dreams, and I can't find it anywhere, because it was so, because then I know de Blasio is de Blasio, but he had a cameo in it, and they asked about Steve Sachs and like being wanted for murder, and he was like, all I can say is the investigation is ongoing. So like, it was so good. And I don't even think, Ken Griffey Jr. I think only has one line in it. And I was live tweeting a pod of their own, the game, the other day. And I was like, I need to tweet something. And I was doing all Simpsons themes. I was like, that episode is so rich. I was like, they give me something. You need to win so I can tweet it. And They finally did. So I think, I know it's not a movie, but baseball wise, and like the end song is just so nostalgic. The talking softball, like, I know it's like, I think talking baseball is a real song that they got these people to do, but it's just, it's like what you think of when you hear like classic baseball music. And
I forgot to shout out, if we're, you know, we talked about an episode television show. What about the best baseball scene of all time, which is, of course, the scene in Twilight where they play baseball?
Oh, yeah. God.
Yeah.
That is iconic. That rewrote the that should be in the next inning of Ken Burns baseball.
Yes, absolutely.
Like, it doesn't start with the screwed up perfect game or the Cubs or anything like that. It starts with the Twilight
baseball scene. That's history right there.
Starts with Twilight baseball scene. I'm on board with that. Kellyanne, do you have a favorite baseball movie?
Okay, so I am nowhere close to a movie buff. I have seen only 4 baseball films, which actually is probably more than most other genres I have seen. So I'm going to just go back in chronological order because my favorite is at the end. So I've seen 42, Moneyball, The Natural, and probably my favorite, because it's just a little silly, but I love it because Frank Sinatra and Gene Kelly are both in it. Oh. Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
I like Take Me Out to the Ball Game, but it also has one of the world's like weirdest songs in it, where they're like singing about underage girls, and yeah. That's a weird vibe in the film.
It's like the film has like silly vibes all over the place, but I just like Gene Kelly and Frank Sinatra doing Take Me Out to the Ball Game, and there's another number. I can't remember what it's called, but I just really like that film. Just because of Frank Sinatra and Gene Kelly.
Can I have confirmation that you have never seen A League of Their Own?
Yeah, I'm giving you homework. Excuse me? I'm giving you homework. You can't be on this podcast, and I've seen the movie that it is named after. Excuse me.
Well, I was going to say, there are so many famous movies that I have not seen. Like, you guys are talking about all these Oscar films, and I'm like, I have not seen one of these films. I was going to say, the last film I saw in the theaters was The Rise of Skywalker. Probably the only new movie I watched this year was La Vida Davanti a Sé, which is The Life Ahead with Sofia Loren. And I'm just
that could
like,
win best song.
Yeah, it's better win best song. That song is so good.
I don't think it's going to
win. Where
best
do I find these movies?
Great. On all the streaming services.
Don't even tell
me
that.
But I don't have any.
I don't think it's going to win best song. I like... Could it? Yes. Do I want it to? Actually, yes. I want to see Diane Warren finally win for once
it's
in her life.
Such a freaking good song.
But, like, you have... So, Speak Now is, like, the easy choice. That's, like, kind of, like, your typical Oscar song winner. I kind of feel like it might be the song from Judas and the Black Messiah.
Haven't listened to her.
Oh, yeah. That was
haven't
good.
Listened to that one.
Because, like, her just keeps winning these awards that no one's expecting her to, and I'm into it. Like, I love her. But, like, I feel like she's just going to swoop in and take this one.
But
don't even tell me that. I mean, mad that
you guys. I've only seen a lot of these movies because I live with a movie buff now, and I grew up with a movie buff. So it's, I think if it wasn't for the influence of my dad and Michael, I would not have seen nearly as many movies as I have, and I haven't seen that many. It's just I usually like see the Oscar contenders every year, and that's like almost it. Like I don't actually venture that far out of like critically acclaimed films. Really.
But find me a streaming platform that A League of Their Own is on and I will watch it.
I own the DVD, so I will literally, next time that we see each other, I will literally bring it with me and force you to watch it. I have it on DVD.
That might be it's like HBO Max. Oh, okay.
Is
Thank
it
you.
On HBO Max? Fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay. That's it. Thank you.
There you go.
Have HBO
now
Max.
You have to. Now you have no choice. All right. So I mean, I'm going to be very stereotypical here. My favorite baseball film of all time is A League of Their Own, and it is one of my like top 5 movies, period. So yes, by far. But
Ada, I just want to tease a little bit since we're talking about baseball films. It is also one of the favorite baseball films of a current reliever on the New York Mets.
Yes, we will get to exactly what Grace is teasing in a moment. But that's such a good tease for that.
That is.
So yeah, A League of Their Own is one of my favorite films of all time. Not just baseball, but period. So that's my favorite. But I will also shout a couple of other faves of mine. I love Bad News Bears and I love The Sandlot. Those are like two other, like, those are kind of my baseball trifecta, I think. But Grace talked about baseball documentaries, and that made me think of another, like, low-key, really good baseball documentary that I highly recommend if you have not seen it, is The Battered Bastards of Baseball. It came out in roughly 2014 or so. I know I was in grad school when it came out, and I watched it when I was in grad school. But it's so good. It's basically about when the famous Hollywood actor Bing Russell started the only indie league team in America at the time. So it's about how, like, Bing Russell basically helped found indie league baseball. And I think that it's like kind of a timely film now with, you know, the way that Major League Baseball is kind of killing the minor leagues and killing the indie leagues to celebrate indie league baseball and its traditions. And The Battered Bastards of Baseball is such a great story. And I highly recommend it. So if you haven't seen that documentary, I recommend it. So that'll be my entry into the baseball documentary category. Along
Does
with Ken
Five
Burns,
Days in Flushing count as a documentary?
I mean, yes.
That was really good, even though we know how it turns out now, and it's not a happy ending. But
see, to me, like, I know the World Series we didn't win, but still, it was such a happy year. I loved the journey there. I mean, it sucks that we didn't win the World Series, but I still enjoyed that season so freaking much.
It sucks because David Wright and Matt Harvey didn't get their happy endings.
Yeah.
Yes. Another,
like, I can deal with them losing the World Series, like, fine, like, it sucks, but I can deal with it. But those two, and Cespedes too, like, everything that happens after that is what sucks.
Another baseball documentary that features the Mets in a more indirect way is Knuckleball, which is a really good baseball documentary about knuckleballs. and
I believe that's on Netflix.
I think it is. So heavily features R.A. Dickey, obviously. And
Robert Allen.
And his time with the Mets. So, yeah, that's another one I recommend. It's good.
Before we move on, I just want to say, in terms of baseball documentaries, obviously I mentioned Ken Burns Baseball. When the Blu-ray comes out, I'm going to find the official timestamps. When you watch the 10th inning of Ken Burns Baseball, there are two photographs that my grandfather is actually in.
That's awesome.
That is so cool.
He worked for the commissioner of baseball. He was like his head of security, whatever. So there's two photos during like the Pete Rose segment with Faye Vincent, where you can see my grandfather clearly on camera, like in
that
the picture.
So cool.
Amazing. Amazing. So before we do Walk Off Wins, Grace alluded to this, and so we're gonna mention it. You should look in your podcast feeds on Friday for a very special Amazing Avenue in Conversation featuring Grace and a certain Mets reliever who is himself very into movies, we have heard.
Woo! And I also wanted, I don't know if this is okay for me to tease, but that might not be the last time I talk to people related to the Mets about movies.
Yes!
So that was just something today. I'm not going to say anything more about that, but that might not be the last time you hear my voice over your earbuds.
Hell,
ooh,
yeah.
That's cool. So exciting.
More movie content from Grace coming your way, and various Mets and Mets adjacent people potentially. but we will finish the show like we do every week with Walk Off Wins, where each of us talks about something that is making us happy this week, baseball related or otherwise. Grace Carbone, what is your Walk Off Win?
Well, we already covered the Oscars, which is my Super Bowl. So this is a big week for me, but also it just came out today officially, but I did get the early release playing of it. MLB The Show 21 just came out, which the deluxe edition features my favorite baseball player of all time, Jackie Robinson, on the cover. And I've been having a lot of fun and wasting a lot of time playing that game. So that's my walk-off win this week is, in fact, a probable walk-off win in one of the games I play.
Heck yes. Kellyanne Healy, what is your walk-off win for this week?
Dear God, I don't even know. I'm fully vaccinated now. Yay, Team Pfizer.
Moderna Mafia.
Moderna Mafia.
I had a very productive week at work. We'll go with that one. I planned out most of the summer programs. I feel like I said this like a week or two ago. But yeah, I'm looking forward to the summer programs at my library.
Awesome. And I should mention, I'm Jay and Jay Crew, so we have every single major vaccine represented on this podcast today. I don't advertise that as often as usual anymore, but it's okay. J&J will return to its former glory eventually.
While I just show off my Pfizer elitism.
Yes, yes. The elitist vaccine.
Yeah.
Linda Surovich, what is your walk-off win for this week?
My walk-off win is also that I'm part of the Moderna Mafia. Well, because I got my second shot, so I'm like fully vaxxed now. And I had such anxiety going into it. Like, my stomach was in knots, and, you know, I just didn't know how I was going to react to it. And I just kept drinking water beforehand, like, finish one bottle, pick up another one, pick up Gatorade. And it really wasn't bad. Like, I just had, like, a few night sweats. My arm's still killing me. But you know what? It's totally worth it. Like, I'm just waiting. I'm waiting for May Mets tickets to go on sale, because I was like, oh, I can actually go now. Like, pull out my vaccination card. Like, you have to let me in now. You can't keep me out anymore. So, you know, and like, my sister went today, so she got her second shot. She's fully vaccinated, or, you know, in 2 weeks when the antibodies build up. But she said she almost cried because the person giving her vaccine said, summer 2021, here you come.
And that's awesome.
She was like, oh my God, you're right. I can do stuff again. So it's just nice knowing, you know, it's not going to be normal, but at least, you know, you can make plans again. And Mets put my tickets on sale. I'm just waiting.
I literally have the June Mets Orioles game at Camden Yards circled on my calendar. Literally.
Oh, yes. You have to go.
Oh, that's happening. 100%. And if Matt Harvey isn't pitching, I'll cry.
Oh, no. Is it only a 2-game series?
It's only a 2-game series.
Oh.
And so my walk-off win for this week, I mean, I guess I should also mention that I will be officially fully vaccinated like 2 weeks out from my shot, literally as you hear this podcast, because tomorrow I will be fully vaccinated, which is very exciting. But my actual walk-off win is that my cousin's wife had her baby. So we have a new baby in the family.
Boy or girl?
A girl named Ella Florence. Her middle name is after my late grandmother. I was so happy to see that they honored my grandma with her name. I mean, my cousin and my grandma were always super close, so it doesn't surprise me. But it's awesome. We're very excited, and I'm very excited that I will be fully vaccinated, so I can potentially go visit the new little baby. So,
yay!
That's
logo. Exciting.
Yes. So that does it for the show this week. You should check all of our content out on AmazingAvenue.com. We're doing all the game recaps, which frequently feature doubleheaders now. So just like all the game recaps, all the content we're doing. I've brought back the Player Meter series, so that goes up every Monday. That was another like feature that we used to do before COVID and kind of like went away during the weird COVID season that I've brought back again.
Okay, tell a fun little story about my first recap of the year.
Yes, please do.
My first recap of the year was Sunday, Marcus Stroman's game. And of course, I was tense the whole time because it's a 2-1 game in Coors. Like, no lead is safe. Like, come on, guys. So the game got over around 6 o'clock, which is Maddie's dinner time. And literally, I saw her get up because she was sleeping. And right at 6 o'clock, she gets up like, okay, come on, let's go, dinner time. And right as McCann is throwing the ball the second, she runs across my keyboard and like just starts writing things in my recap. I was like, no! So, like, just the worst absolute timing. So I had to, like, click delete everything that I didn't know if it was out, if he was safe. And I had to, like, get her off the keyboard. So it was just, like, this comedy of errors for my very first recap of the game. But at least I got to recap a win, so.
There you go. That's, I also got to recap timing. A don't, win.
Yeah, don't recap, like, don't end the game at Maddie's dinner time next time. I'm begging.
Yes. Please take Maddie's dinner time into account. That's where we're begging you.
Yeah, help us out.
But yeah, we have game recaps going up every day for you guys. We've got the Player Meter series. Chris McShane is doing a series where he follows Jacob deGrom's every start, because why wouldn't you? So we've got all the content for you guys at AmazingAvenue.com. You can follow the site on all the social medias, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, at Amazing Avenue. Grace Carbone, where can people find you on the internet?
OD Guitar is usually my name on everything, so at OD Guitar on Twitter. And if you're so inclined, if you're a film buff like me and you have Letterboxd, I'm also OD Guitar on there.
Heck yeah. You can follow Grace on Twitter and see her work over at AmazingAvenue.com. You can follow the show on Twitter at A Pod of Their Own. You can follow each of us on Twitter. I am at Petite PhD. Where are you, Linda?
At Linda Cerevich.
And you, Kellyanne?
At LRBELLARE BEE.
And you should subscribe to the podcast, Amazing Avenue Audio, wherever you get your podcasts from. Like we said, very important to subscribe this week, because a very important episode will be dropping on Friday, featuring our very own Grace. So you should subscribe, rate, and review the show. It really helps people find it. The original intro and outro music to this podcast is by Bunga. Let's go Mets, and don't forget, there is no crying in podcasting.